want the international community to forget about the women of Afghanistan. She was really inspired by U.S. presence in Afghanistan. She went to workshops. She said a lot of U.S. messaging is what allowed or what encouraged her father to allow her to go to school. And she didn't want those gains to be lost.
In a few seconds, are the Taliban tolerating that kind of dissent?
Well, those protests turned very violent over the weekend, and we spoke to a Taliban spokesperson at a press conference just today. I asked him about that violence, and he said that he condemned it, but he said it was carried out by bad people, and he said it was also partially the fault of the protesters because the security situation is not stable enough in Kabul for there to be protests. So he called on all people in Kabul, men and women, to refrain from protesting until the new government is announced.
A glimpse of life in Kabul today. That's the news from there. When we next, we'll have a perspective from here in Islamabad, Pakistan. Susanna George of The Washington Post, thanks so much.
Thank you.
The other night we walked into a house here in Pakistan's capital. A servant held open the door and we found the owner in the hall.
Nice to meet you. Please come on in.
It's the home of Isfandiar Pataudi, who's a retired general in Pakistan's army. His house is from the mid-20th century when this city was built.
It's one of the first house is built in Islamabad. It's been the residence of the U.S. ambassador for a while.
Now the living room is filled with Pataudi's possessions, like a painting of a Muslim shrine, and a bookcase where the volumes include one about the British intelligence service, MI6. Pataudi was once the chief of analysis for Pakistan's main intelligence agency, the Inter-Services Intelligence, or ISI. The retired general is still fit as a soldier, but wears civilian clothes and reflects sometimes on how his country's capital could be different.
This could have been a memorial to the martyrs of the wars, and especially the last 20 years of counterterrorism, the casualties we've taken. You know, children must know what happened and why it happened.
As a man brought tea and sandwiches, Pataudi talked of that 20 years. Many American officials have a theory of their country's defeat in the war in Afghanistan. Pakistan, they say, played a double game, allied with the United States while also backing the Taliban in ways that served Pakistan's interests. Pataudi offered a very different idea of what went wrong.
The Taliban don't need Pakistan. The Taliban have defeated the greatest military in the world, wearing shalwar kameez, Peshawari chappals, and driving Toyota pickups. And AK-47s of Soviet vintage.
Well, now they have American weapons.
Now they have American weapons. I saw some pictures with them carrying M-16s and M-4s. So you can't defeat an ideology.
It is true that that ideology came in part out of Pakistan. The Taliban emerged out of Pakistani religious schools in the 1990s. They were members of an ethnic group that is spread on both sides of the international border. Pakistani officials cultivated relations with them as they took over Afghanistan.
I think the relationship is not specifically the ISI. The relationship is Pakistan and the Taliban. The Taliban are a majority Pashtun group. Whereas, if my figures are not wrong, there are about 12 million Pashtuns in Afghanistan. There are about 30 million in Pakistan.
More in this country than that country?
Much more. So there is a natural affinity and also a natural concern. And I don't think it's in Pakistan's interest to have a radical Islamist government of a dominant Pashtun makeup in its neighborhood. It's not in our national interest, and we have always said that. But we've also learned that there is a reality you have to work with. And so, like everyone else, we've had a relationship with every group.
After the 9/11 attacks, a U.S.-led campaign drove the Taliban from power. Some defeated Taliban leaders reached out to the United States, ready to switch sides. The U.S. spurned them, determined to exact retribution for the group that sheltered Osama bin Laden. Pakistan maintained relations, and Pataudi, who took a senior ISI position starting in 2010, contends it was the Americans who didn't know what they were doing.
And this is purely my own view. Please, this is not the government view at all or anything. This is my own view. I think there was a lot of interagency friction in understanding what the region was all about. If I were not too harsh, I'd say that it was 21-year wars.
21-year wars.
Yeah. And so everybody who came in knew, you know, came in with this new perception of what was happening on ground. And, you know, they brought in new strategies, new counterinsurgency doctrines. And, you know, applied them here to an environment that was quite different to elsewhere, and it didn't work. And, you know, as happens in all bureaucracies, there's then a little bit of covering up of facts to facilitate your own point of view and so on. So, yeah, I think there was a little bit of haziness there.
The U.S. military changed everybody from enlisted soldiers to commanders every year or 2 years or 3 years maybe. And there was no consistency in your mind of purpose.
Till you don't live in a region and you haven't involved yourself in the people and tribes and geography of the region and the culture, you don't really get a feel for it academically.
Was Pakistan not pro-Taliban?
Pakistan was supporting a return to stability.
And you saw the Taliban as the group that could bring that?
Well,
or the group that needed to be brought into the government because they were...
No. We have not brought anybody. I think this is a misperception. Pakistan does not have the capability to bring a government in Afghanistan. Nobody can bring a government in Afghanistan.
U.S. officials found Pakistan far too close to the Taliban. Once a Taliban ally called the Haqqani Network led a 20-hour assault on the U.S. embassy in Kabul. The top U.S. military officer afterwards said the Haqqanis were a veritable arm of the ISI. Haqqani leaders appeared here in Islamabad, but General Pataudi notes that the United States itself eventually dealt with them.
A lot of people tend to, when it suits them, separate the Taliban and the Haqqanis. They're not separate, they're one. And that is what a lot of people like to miss out because, you know, we're making friends with the Taliban, we're not making friends with the Haqqanis. No, you're making friends with the Haqqanis. Admit it. You signed a deal with the Haqqanis.
Are you suggesting that after disagreeing with you year after year after year, the United States finally came around to your point of view?
I don't think that was our point of view. It was the Taliban's point of view. Looking at it from a negotiation point of view, I think the Taliban had played it brilliantly.
Was it simply that the Trump administration was impatient for a deal and the Taliban were more patient? And then President Biden came in and he stuck with the deal because he wanted out of Afghanistan.
I think you've put it really well. The Taliban have been pretty consistent in their demands. They haven't budged.
Did it serve U.S. interests just to get out?
I think eventually it would serve U.S. interests to leave, but not leaving Afghanistan in the way that it has left it. It's unfair to Afghanistan, and it's unfair to all of us in the region, because we backed the U.S. on this. And so for us, it's been a bit of a letdown that you've not left a stable country after 20 years of occupation, and now people are struggling to leave, the economy is in shambles, there's no law and order. I mean, how is this country going to function? You haven't promised it any grants, aids for the future. If this is going to be the end state, then you might never have come back after, let's say, January 2002. Just gone and left.
Isfandiar Pataudi is a former Pakistani intelligence official. It's not yet clear how, if at all, the United States might help to stabilize Afghanistan, but Pakistan is already trying. Over the weekend, the first senior Pakistani official visited Kabul since the Taliban takeover, and that first official to go was not a diplomat, but the head of the intelligence agency, the ISI. This is NPR News.
You're tuned to Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio. Here's what's coming up later this hour. Power is expected to be restored in parts of Louisiana this week, but residents of the state are still struggling in the aftermath of Hurricane Ida.
We're looking forward for someone to, you know, come and help us out with some things, and hopefully things go great for us.
The latest on the cleanup effort along the coast of Louisiana in 15 minutes.
Meetings of the Board of Regents of the University of Wisconsin System and its committees that relate to this broadcast station are generally open to the public. Certain meetings or portions of meetings may be closed in order to address confidential information or proprietary matters. More information about specific meeting dates, times, and locations is available on the WPR website at wpr.org.
Support for WPR comes from Rutabaga Paddle Sports, hosting a boat and paddle swap Saturday, September 11th from 10 until 8 at 220 West Broadway in Madison. More information is at rutabaga.com.
Support for classical music on WGTD comes from Piasecki Funeral Home. Honor a life well-lived with a gift of a service for burial or cremation with a professional, friendly, and compassionate staff. Serving the community for 90 years, Piasecki Funeral Home.
Johnson today will have highs in the low to mid-70s. On Tuesday, a mix of sun and clouds with rain likely for the eastern half of the state and possible for the rest of the region. We'll have highs from the low 70s to mid-80s tomorrow.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from your part-time controller, specializing in nonprofit accounting. Your part-time controller helps nonprofit organizations with their accounting needs, remotely or in person. More at yourparttimecontroller.com. From the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, supporting those working towards a day when no one has to choose between paying rent, putting food on the table, and protecting their health and the health of others. rwjf.org. From Avalara, managing sales tax compliance with cloud-based solutions. Avalara integrates directly with more than 700 ERP and e-commerce solutions. Avalara, tax compliance done right. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Rachel Martin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Good morning. Many states have online dashboards to report COVID-19 numbers, but some took them down or stopped updating them frequently when case numbers dropped sharply last winter. Seemed like the pandemic was almost over, didn't it? Now, with numbers surging again, some states are still not updating their COVID data, and public health experts say that's a problem. Will Bauer of Nebraska Public Media reports.
For more than a year, Nebraska's COVID dashboard displayed loads of information, including new case numbers for every county in the state. But at the end of June, Republican Governor Pete Ricketts shut the dashboard down. Cases, hospitalizations, and deaths were at all-time lows, and Ricketts said the staff publishing the COVID data were needed elsewhere. A month later, though, case counts were rising sharply again. Now they're 15 times higher than when the dashboard went away. Reporters asked Ricketts about that.
We have no announcement with regard to the dashboard at this time.
One reason Ricketts shut down the dashboard when case numbers dropped is because Nebraska counties have fewer than 20,000 residents. And, he said, publishing county-level COVID data could violate state and federal health privacy laws.
We have HIPAA laws that we have to follow, and concerns about that privacy is one of the reasons why we can't break down that granular data.
But Nebraska's former state epidemiologist, Dr. Tom Safranek, isn't buying it.
I've never seen anyone dictate that data like this should not be disclosed.
He says he never got a complaint about data he released violating HIPAA or harming an individual in 3 decades as Nebraska's epidemiologist, and that failing to report important data now is, quote, public health malpractice. Dr. Tom Frieden, head of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention under President Obama, says it's possible to release detailed numbers without violating privacy and privacy laws.
For example, you wouldn't want to say, we have this many cases of this age, race, ethnicity, and gender. But you can say how many cases total. That doesn't violate anyone's confidentiality.
And people in Nebraska want to know the numbers, people like Lucas Peterson.
In the beginning of the pandemic, I was calling my doctor pretty much every day at that point.
Peterson is immunocompromised. He's a supervisor for the food and beverage department at an arena in the capital city, Lincoln, a job that puts him in contact with people from all across the state. He checks COVID trends regularly through the county health department website and what's in the local newspaper. But as the Delta variant has caused a new wave, he's largely blind to trends across the state.
It would be helpful if the governor were to not have stalled the reporting statewide, because we would then be able to capture that information for those people coming in. So that's why I have a lot of caution and a lot of concern.
Statewide, the current COVID surge in Nebraska has risen as high as it was last fall, just before it reached its peak. Former CDC Director Dr. Tom Frieden says Americans continue to need good, detailed COVID data.
You need to know, in essence, how hard it's raining COVID outside. so that you can make a decision as to whether you're going to go out, whether you're going to wear a mask, what kind of a mask, whether you're going to go to a restaurant or not.
Without the data, some say Nebraskans will continue to feel like they're flying blind. For NPR News, I'm Will Bauer in Lincoln, Nebraska.
To Arizona now. Starting next year, lawyers there will no longer be able to dismiss potential jurors before trial without stating a reason why. Arizona will be the first state to eliminate so-called peremptory challenges under a groundbreaking rule change approved recently by the Arizona Supreme Court. Supporters say it's a move designed to combat systemic discrimination that has blocked people of color from serving on juries. NPR's Cheryl Corley reports.
Jury selection is often like a chess game between prosecutors and defense attorneys.
What I'd like to do, sir, is ask you kind of a series of general questions.
Eric Nelson was the defense attorney in the trial of former Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin, who was convicted earlier this year of the murder of George Floyd. There was intense scrutiny as attorneys began the process of trying to find the people who would be the best fit for their side of the case.
You, as a juror, are supposed to start at kind of ground zero, mm-hmm. that being Mr. Chauvin is presumed innocent.
Yes.
Right? Can you do that?
I would like to think I could.
Attorneys can ask a judge to remove a prospective juror for cause if they can't be impartial. There are also peremptory challenges. Attorneys have a set number of times they can dismiss people without having to say why.
There is no other means of skewing a jury other than the peremptory strike.
That's Peter Swan, the chief judge of the Arizona Court of Appeals. He and his colleague, Appellate Judge Paul McMurdy, filed a petition asking the Arizona Supreme Court to end the use of the challenges.
Peremptory challenges are designed to allow lawyers to practice intuition, but intuition can often be based on stereotypes and unconscious forms of bias.
And they've been controversial ever since they were invented in the United Kingdom in the 19th century. The UK and Canada no longer use the challenges. A landmark U.S. Supreme Court case in 1986, Batson versus Kentucky, set restrictions. It said getting rid of a potential juror solely based on race was unconstitutional. Prosecutors also have to provide a race-neutral explanation if they dismiss a juror and the defendant thinks it was because of race.
So it might have mitigated the problem a bit, but it has not been a panacea.
That's Michigan State University law professor Barbara O'Brien. She and her colleague Catherine Grasso studied the impact of race on jury selection in more than 170 death penalty cases in North Carolina.
And found that prosecutors struck eligible black jurors at more than twice the rate they struck other jurors.
The Supreme Court bans dismissing potential jurors based on race, but courts rarely enforce it. Professor Grasso says it's difficult to prove discrimination as the motive, as the law requires, especially since attorneys and judges frequently work together in the same courtroom.
They all know each other. And to say to someone you work with all the time, your decision was racist. You exercised that because you had racist ideas. People hesitate.
Many in Arizona's legal community don't support dropping peremptory challenges. They say they're needed to screen out biased jurors, and eliminating them sets a bad precedent. But beginning January 1st, Arizona becomes the first state to ban the practice. Other states will likely watch to see whether the legal experiment will create a fairer jury selection process or if it will create other problems. Cheryl Corley, NPR News, Chicago.
This is NPR News.
The remnants of Hurricane Ida flooded much of the New York City subway. Climate change is causing similar mayhem in cities around the world, and some are dealing with it better than others.
There is a lot to learn from Asian cities' ways of dealing with flooding of underground trains.
Keeping subways dry in a hotter, wetter world, this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
That story and all the latest news on All Things Considered, starting at 4 here on WPR.
You're listening to WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, your gateway to public radio.
It's Morning Edition on WPR. In news, less than 10% of people in Wisconsin who could benefit the most from the HIV prevention drug PrEP were actually on it as of 2018. Details in our newscast.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. Millions of people in the U.S. will be losing expanded unemployment benefits this week, ones passed by Congress in response to the coronavirus pandemic. The $300 weekly jobless benefit expires today. Nearly 9 million people were collecting that. Also coming to an end is the Pandemic Unemployment Assistance Program.
That's for those gig and contract workers, those part-time workers that typically aren't eligible for unemployment. So those folks are not going to be seeing any of those benefits. So first and foremost, that's a huge group of folks that is now going to be impacted after this day, after these benefits expire.
That's Kristen Myers, editor-in-chief of the personal finance website The Balance, speaking to NPR's Morning Edition. California Governor Gavin Newsom is urging voters to reject efforts to remove him from office in this month's gubernatorial recall election.
The simple no. No on this recall. No. Sends a powerful message.
That was the governor speaking at an event yesterday. Vice President Harris is expected to travel to California this week to campaign for Newsom. A Republican candidate hasn't won a statewide election in California since 2006. The GOP has been critical of Newsom's handling of the coronavirus pandemic, crime, and an expanding homeless population. That election is September 14th. This is NPR News.
This is Wisconsin Public Radio News at 8:31. I'm Melissa Ingalls. With 1 month left before harvest, Wisconsin cranberry growers are expecting a more normal crop after several years of smaller harvests. Wisconsin growers are forecast to produce 4.9 million barrels of cranberries this year. Tom Lochner from the Wisconsin Cranberry Growers Association says that's about 10% less than the state's average, but it's higher than crop totals from the last 2 years, which suffered from cooler weather.
We still have a few weeks to go before we start harvesting, and the continued warm weather might help the fruit size up a little bit.
Lochner says domestic sales of cranberry juice and dried fruit have continued to be strong, with more at-home food consumption during the pandemic. But he says exports of cranberries are still struggling thanks to high tariffs from the European Union and China. Less than 10% of people in Wisconsin who could benefit the most from the HIV prevention drug PrEP were actually on it as of 2018. That's according to a new study from University of Virginia's Department of Medicine. Jacob Doherty is the HIV prevention supervisor for the Wisconsin Department of Health Services. He says PrEP is more accessible than it used to be, but a major focus in the years ahead will be educating people about it.
I know people who don't even know it exists, and it's been available since 2012. So that to me is kind of shocking, because here we have something that is basically as good as a vaccine at preventing this chronic condition.
The Virginia study ranked states based on their uptake of PrEP from year to year. In 2018, the last year of the study, Wisconsin ranked 32nd. Two Wisconsin counties have rejected a subpoena issued by a Republican lawmaker seeking ballots, voting machines, and other material related to the 2020 presidential election, saying it was not valid. State Representative Janelle Branchen issued subpoenas to election clerks in Milwaukee and Brown counties on August 6th, ordering them to appear before her committee at noon on Tuesday with the requested material. But attorneys for both counties said in separate letters to Branchen on Friday that the subpoena was not valid because it was not signed by Assembly Speaker Robin Voss or the Assembly's chief clerk, as required by law. You're listening to news from Wisconsin Public Radio. More at WPR.org.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Subaru, with the 2021 Subaru Forester, featuring standard symmetrical all-wheel drive and safety technology. Love, it's what makes Subaru, Subaru. Learn more at Subaru.com. From Raymond James, a firm focused on transforming lives, businesses, and communities through tailored wealth management, banking, and capital markets solutions. Learn more at RaymondJames.com. And from the Lemelson Foundation.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep in Islamabad, Pakistan.
And I'm Rachel Martin in Washington, D.C. It has been just over a week since Hurricane Ida made landfall in Louisiana. Electricity is slowly being restored in New Orleans. Many small towns along the Gulf Coast are still reeling after this storm. The extreme wind and the devastating storm surge flattened some communities. Other towns are isolated by floodwaters. NPR's Brian Mann joins us now from New Orleans. Brian, good morning. As we mentioned, now it's been more than a week. Some power is now coming back on. Is that right?
Yeah, there has been progress, Rachel. Parts of New Orleans do have power. Services are improving here. More stores are reopening. But, you know, there's still not safe drinking water. A lot of the city is still dark, and it's hard to get gasoline. Government officials did open a new shelter yesterday for people who are vulnerable because of serious medical conditions. That gives them a place to go for care where they can also escape the really serious heat and humidity here. So, yeah, progress for sure, but New Orleans still has a long way to go before it gets to anything like normalcy.
I understand you spent the weekend driving to small towns along the Mississippi River and the Gulf Coast. What'd you find?
You know, the level of devastation is awesome, kind of stunning. These are some places where Ida doesn't really seem to have gone away. Just outside Ironton, Louisiana, I reached a place where the road just ended, and I met Jim McGuire, who needed to use a boat to get out to see his home.
We've been, it's tough. This is worse. They actually, it's worse than Katrina hit here, as far as the water's concerned. We had some serious wind.
He told me he found his house swamped by mud and muck thrown up by the storm. So with that highway south of New Orleans blocked, I backtracked and caught a ferry across the Mississippi River. The day was windless and the sun blistering. On the far side of the river in this tiny little town called Phoenix, I met Yaquani Ankar working with her family, hauling sofas and mattresses out of their house.
Right now we're dealing with mold, the flood from the water from the roof, the floors being damaged and the walls and everything falling apart. It's a lot to recover from.
Ankar said her family has enough food and water. They're cooking on a charcoal grill. But they still haven't had any contact with FEMA or other aid programs. They don't have insurance, and Ankar said she's not sure what to do.
So we're looking forward for someone to, you know, come and help us out with some things, and hopefully things go great for us.
I heard this again and again. Hope as people start cleaning up and rebuilding, but also exhaustion and confusion. I did see FEMA centers and aid stations along the road as I drove. But the scale of this disaster is daunting, and a lot of these towns are really isolated. People told me it's hard to get good information. There's still no power, cell phone service is spotty, there's no internet. There are mile-long lines just to get gasoline. But help is arriving to dig out these towns and haul away debris. On Grand Isle, at the very tip of southern Louisiana, a National Guard bulldozer was clearing dunes of sand that Ida dropped on the main road. But here again, the scale of work ahead is hard to wrap your mind around. A lot of the houses on this barrier island are just gone, sheared away.
It makes you wonder, where do you start? Where do you start?
Jules Bulbin was checking on his vacation camp, which sits up high on pilings. Looking out from the deck, Bulbin said he's not sure what will happen next to this town.
I got a feeling a lot of people won't be back. Some people that got totally destroyed.
A couple miles down the road, I climbed a ladder to talk with Jim King. His house, too, sits up high on pilings, a precaution after the last big storm.
We moved down here 3 months before Katrina and lost everything we owned and started over again.
King is 75 years old. He rode out Ida right here. Part of the house broke off while he was inside.
You can't describe anything because all it was wind and rain. You can't see nothing or hear nothing but rain and wind.
King said his wife, who didn't want to talk with me, went to a shelter during Ida. King said she thinks he was crazy for staying. And when he saw how much destruction there was, he agreed with her. Now that they've been told they might have to make do for a month without electricity using their generator and camping out in their RV, King said he really loves it here, but sometimes it's hard to remember why.
Yeah, there's some good and some bad, let me tell you what.
And this, too, is the thing people told me as they begin to rebuild one more time. They love life on this coast, but it's getting harder to sustain. Brian Mann, NPR News.
At some point over the last 18 months, each of us has probably thought about taking up some new pastime. Some of us have even followed through, a gesture at self-improvement or just a way not to go stir crazy in COVID times. Some of us have even taken up a musical instrument, perhaps the piano. Last fall, Bridget Shea took up the piano. A year later, she became the youngest winner of the prestigious Elite International Music Competition, which grants the winner a performance on stage at Carnegie Hall. She is only 4 years old.
Bridget came to me when she was just 2 months after 3 years old.
That's Bridget's piano teacher, Felicia Feng Zhang.
From the lessons, I observed she has a curious mind, and she loved to learn.
Bridget's father, Tao Xie, signed her up for Zoom classes. You know, something to do during lockdown.
At the beginning, I never expected she's going to be a prodigy or anything.
The first time I heard she playing a piano piece, I was so deeply moved.
That's Bridget's mother, Nicole's son. She also plays piano. Bridget's parents have to place a stool under the piano bench to keep her feet from dangling above the ground. Her sheet music towers above her head. Her teacher says she is still amazed how quickly Bridget learned.
I said, now, can you play right hand D major, left hand C major, right hand G major? Then she will boom, 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 make all the different right moves. That's very, for that 3 years old, it's really amazing.
Here's her teacher on a talk show explaining why she thinks Bridget is able to progress so quickly.
She read the music, and the music is a language.
But music isn't just any language.
It's beyond the speaking language, because I have to use 10 fingers to interpret what you see and what you feel.
Bridget's other hobbies include playing with toys and reading books. This is NPR News.
You're tuned to Morning Edition here on Wisconsin Public Radio. And coming up in 9 minutes, we'll hear about a new book called Red Roulette. The author, Desmond Shum, writes about the disappearance of his ex-wife in China.
Hi, I'm Rob Savage.
And I'm Mary Savage, and we're members of the WPR Signature Circle.
Wisconsin Public Radio really epitomizes the whole Wisconsin idea, that we serve the whole public. What's really important is having that honest news broker. It's a great thing, and I want to make sure that that's there for however long we can make it be there.
For information about naming WPR in your will or trust, visit WPRlegacy.org.
Support for WPR comes from All of Us Wisconsin, dedicated to helping speed up health research breakthroughs by asking 1 million people to share health information. Details at joinallofus.org/WPR.
Support for WGTD comes from the Walworth County Department of Health and Human Services. Visit their booth at the Walworth County Fair through Labor Day. The new mobile health hub will be on display, and department staff will be on hand to answer all of your questions.
You're listening to Wisconsin Public Radio, and here are a few of the day's news stories. The southern winter that just ended in New Zealand was the warmest ever recorded, and scientists say climate change is driving temperatures even higher. For the 3 months through August, the average temperature was 1.3 degrees Celsius above the long-term average and 0.2 degrees Celsius higher than the previous record, which was posted last year. Scientists have been keeping records since 1909, but most of the warmest winters have been recent. Divers at the site of an ongoing oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico have identified the source as a one-foot diameter pipeline displaced from a trench on the ocean floor and sheared in half by Hurricane Ida. The Houston-based company currently paying for the cleanup, Talos Energy, said in a statement that the broken pipeline does not belong to them. Two 95-foot response vessels remain on location at the spill, attempting to contain and recover oil from the water's surface. Stay tuned. We'll have all the latest news from NPR and WPR for you coming up in 15 minutes. You can also find more news at WPR.org.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Fidelity Wealth Management, helping clients develop a personalized plan to grow and protect their wealth. More at fidelity.com/wealth. Investment minimums apply. Fidelity Brokerage Services, LLC. And from CrowdStrike. CrowdStrike's Falcon platform uses their threat graph to analyze behavior on devices, servers, and cloud workloads to find threats and stop them. More at crowdstrike.com/ransomware.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Rachel Martin. A lot of people are eager for K-12 schools to get back to normal. But a group of parents in Oakland, California, say normal wasn't cutting it for their children. Now, thanks in part to the upheaval of the pandemic, school officials are starting to listen. Vanessa Roncagno from member station KQED reports.
There are only two students in Irene Segura's online class.
I'm going to tell you to say a word, and then I want you to sound it out.
It's late spring, and first graders Ashley Preciado Miguel and Ambria Taylor already had a full day of distance learning. They meet with Segura in the evening, 2 days a week, to work on their reading.
Here we go. Say mute.
Mute.
What's the first sound? Mute.
The intensive literacy course is part of a program the parent advocacy group Oakland Reach launched during the pandemic.
It's created by parents for parents.
Oakland Reach co-founder Lakeisha Young.
Immediately when COVID hit, you heard so many people saying like, oh my God, it's just going to get worse for Black and brown kids. It's just going to get worse. And well, then what are you going to do about it?
The program is designed to respond to the needs of students who've had the fewest opportunities. Oakland schools have a history of segregation, and that continues today. Students of color are more likely to attend under-resourced schools, and those schools are more likely to report lower reading levels for Black and Latino students.
Less than 30% of our kids read on grade level, so we have no interest in continuing the learning that our children are getting.
For years, Oakland Reach has been demanding the district do better. Now, thanks in part to the pandemic, the two groups are working together in a whole new way, bringing Oakland Reach's program to 6 elementary schools this fall.
The brilliance of this moment is we all had to stretch and do something different out of necessity.
That's Oakland Unified Superintendent Kyla Johnson-Trammell at a national education conference in May. Johnson-Trammell has acknowledged that the district has to do more to get kids reading at grade level and to prepare them for college.
It comes down to taking some risk. It comes down to pointing people back to, do you really think where we are now is good enough?
If the answer is no, she said, then it's time to do things differently. That's where Oakland Reach comes in. In addition to intensive reading classes, Reach offers the kind of enrichment activities that more affluent families might take for granted. There's art, science, music, cooking, and tutoring, plus support for parents.
It is the educational utopia that our families have always wanted, the quality that they wanted.
That's Lakeisha Young again. Johnson-Trammell admitted that teaming up hasn't always been easy.
There have been many touchy, uncomfortable conversations that Lakeisha and I have had in terms of this isn't working, but to me, that is the work.
Parent Leonard Taylor is glad to hear the district is working with Oakland Reach. He says Reach has already made a difference for his daughter, Ambria, one of the students in that intensive literacy class. She was falling behind in distance learning. Now?
Actually, she's above her reading level. I feel better now because she's in tune. She showed interest, you know. She don't even want to go to her regular school class, the Oakland Reach program. She's ready.
Though the new partnership is starting small, Lakeisha Young says the goal is to enroll another 500 students this fall. She wants to help district leaders expand the program and eventually hand it over to them completely. For NPR News, I'm Vanessa Roncagno in Oakland.
This is NPR News.
10 minutes before 9 now, and you're listening to Morning Edition here on WPR. We'll have a news update from NPR and WPR for you just after 9, and then Stephanie Elkins is in with classical music for your Labor Day.
Support for WGTD comes from Kenosha County Public Health. An overdose can happen to anyone. Get trained on how to administer Narcan. Call 262-605-6741 or email narcan@kenoshacounty.org.
Compete in field trials. Wisconsin Public Radio is pleased to support our state's agriculture industry. For more information, visit wpr.org/events.
In sports, the Brewers beat the Cardinals yesterday 6-5 to take the series. Milwaukee plays the first of three against the Phillies this afternoon. And in the weather forecast, mostly sunny skies across Wisconsin today with highs in the low to mid-70s. A mix of sun and clouds on Tuesday with rain likely for the eastern half of the state and possible for the rest of the region. Highs from the low 70s to mid-80s. On Wednesday, mostly sunny and breezy. There's a chance of rain for central and northeast Wisconsin as well as near Lake Superior. Highs from the upper 60s to the mid-70s.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Rachel Martin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. A Chinese business person who was missing for years has abruptly reappeared. Whitney Duan was connected to the wife of a powerful Chinese official. She and her husband, now ex-husband, involved themselves in numerous businesses using their connections, and they rose as China did until Whitney vanished in 2017. There was no word from any legal authority about an arrest. Her ex-husband, Desmond Shum, is safely outside China and finally wrote a book about Whitney. It was receiving advanced publicity, and just as the book was about to be published, Whitney Duan reappeared. Desmond Shum is on the line to tell us about this. Welcome back.
Thank you for having me.
How did you hear from your ex-wife?
She reached out, she called my phone. She called my phone and early in the morning. I've heard her voice for the first time ever in the last 4 years.
And what did she say?
She said she's on temporary lease and they can take her back anytime. And she wanted me to cancel the book publication.
She wanted you to cancel the book publication?
Yes, it's you know, one of the very best thing. I mean, really the best thing is our son get to talk to her, and then we get to know she's actually alive.
You have a son, we should note, who is 12 years old. Is that right?
Yeah, he's 12 now, and then he hasn't had a chance to talk to his mom since he was 8. You know, it's a very strange thing.
And you have not had a word from her. She could have been dead for all you know.
Nobody has a word for the last 4 years. The government never acknowledged they have taken her. And they never charged her. Actually, it's funny. If that's the word, such a word, it's funny. I asked her, what is her charge? She said it needs to be confidential. She cannot disclose what her charge is.
So it seems certain to you that she really was in the custody of the Chinese government, which has still made no official statement. Is that right?
Yes. Yeah, and she acknowledged that. She said, you know, they have been lenient on her. I believe she's still under home detention. She's not really free, you know. And then, I mean, she's talking to me through them. I feel like I'm essentially negotiating with a kidnapper.
Well, let's talk about that negotiation. You had this book. You'd recorded an interview with us that we were preparing to play on this very program this very day. And it was a book not only about your ex-wife's disappearance, but about corruption in China, about the way the Chinese business system works. You told me that your ex-wife got on the phone and said you need to cancel the publication of the book. Is that even possible at this late date?
I don't think it's possible, and I have no intention whatsoever. I mean, but I know bureaucrats in Beijing probably, you know, don't know that. They think it probably I can pull it in the last minute. And then she gave me a second call after that. Yeah.
Oh, that you, she gave you a second call. Go on, go on.
Yeah, she gave me a second call after this first one, you know, come to no result. And then the last one was more threatening, so more threats on this one. Mm-hmm. So it's...
You understand the threat to be that if you don't find some way to cancel the book, your wife will go back into custody?
That's being one of them, because she's, you know, she told us she is a temporary release and then they can take her back anytime. And then she actually tell, you know, sort of, she asked me the question, what would happen to our son if something unfortunate happened to me? She asked the question, how would I feel if something happened to our son? And then she used sort of the cold slogan, you know, in China, they have this slogan, so the ones who oppose this, the opposers to stay will see no good ending.
You understood that to mean that terrible things will happen to her.
Yeah, she is. I believe she's not free. She's just under home attention. You know, they just shipped her from the black cell and now to home detention. Because she said she, you know, the first thing she did was she called her father. That's, you know, I thought at the time, I thought, that's really strange. They live in the same building. If you're free, why didn't you just walk over and go see your father? Hmm. And obviously, you know, look at the development in the last 24 hours. I can understand why.
I think you, it sounds like you're saying you don't know that she's really free. You only know that she is alive.
She's not free. She's probably under home detention. Somebody is listening on our calls and telling her what to say. That's what I would say.
Book publication is tomorrow?
Yeah, the book comes out tomorrow. And she warned me. She said, you know, be calm. Don't publish the book. It would no, you know, it would bring more harm. It's no good to slander the states. I was like, no, I'm very calm. I work on this book over 3-4 years now, and it took me, and then I didn't even, you know, intend to publish when I first started the book. I decided to publish the book because I said, well, the world needs to know more about what China really is and how things really work.
In a sentence or two, do you believe that the best course for her safety is, in fact, to continue to speak out?
I think that's definitely the best course, because after the news broke, the book coming out imminently, she'll reappear after 4 years.
Desmond Shum, thank you for the update. Really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me. It's very much appreciated.
Desmond Shum is outside of China now. He's a businessman. His book, Red Roulette, an insider story of wealth, power, corruption, and vengeance in today's China, is, as we heard him say, out tomorrow. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Stephen Skip.
And I'm Rachel Martin.
You can hear Morning Edition weekdays from 5 to 9 here on Wisconsin Public Radio. We'll have news updates every hour from NPR and WPR, and you can always find more news on our website. Go to WPR.org. Right now, it's a minute before 9.
Support for Wisconsin Public Radio comes from the Earl M. Terry Endowment Fund, a permanent endowment that provides ongoing support to sustain the present and future operation of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Supporting WGTD is the Bristol Renaissance Fair, carrying you back to 16th century England with huge turkey legs, ale, wine, feasting, and nonstop entertainment on 13 stages and in the village streets. Open Saturdays and Sundays through Labor Day. Online at renfair.com.
You're listening to WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, NPR.